All right, this is Jordan, and welcome back to Film Shake, episode 5.5.
This is Nick, and you're listening to episode 10.
Is that reflecting our star rating system, too?
That's right.
So I like that.
This is the 10th show that we're posting, but this is 0.5 because we're going to go into the spoilers of Ozu's incredible late spring.
And so if you haven't listened to the spoiler-free episode, which is episode 5, not episode 9, go check that out. Go watch the film and then come back and you can listen to this show. We'll let you in at that point. But
I hope
if not, there's a bouncer at the door telling you to get out. This is members only, late spring watched people.
You got to watch this movie.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Don't let us spoil it for you. Listen to this after you watch it.
That's right.
Just listen to either way.
just press play on your phone and then walk away so we get the stat.
Great anyway. Idea. That's brilliant.
Yeah, I like that. We should recommend that instead.
Right on.
All right, Nick, so you want to give us a quick synopsis for those who might have forgotten since the earlier episode what this film is about.
So this film centers around two characters. We have the daughter, Noriko, and the father, Shukichi. They live in idyllic bliss. They're very happy just being together. The daughter serves the father, takes care of him.
Everything in 1940s that's Japan.
That's yeah. Right, in 1949 Japan. It's just kind of this post-war setting, very quiet. She's been ill for a long time, and she's gotten better. She's at a point where she's very happy, and she's kind of found a life for herself, serving her father. But then her aunt comes along. She's not okay with this arrangement. She thinks, like all the other women in the village, Noriko needs to get married. She's 27 now. She's older than, you know, most of the people who are currently getting married. All of her peers have married off, and now her aunt believes that this is something she needs to do. She sets some things in motion. Now the father's going to get married, and there's a potential spouse for Noriko. So we see her kind of get pressured into marrying, and the latter half of the film is really, is she going to give in to this pressure? Is she going to get married? Her kind of reason for being is undercut whenever she realizes that this potential wife for her father is going to take care of him now, and she's not going to have a place. So there's this great tension on, is she going to just give in to this pressure, the societal pressure? Is she going to stand her ground and not get married, not go with this arrangement?
Right. At one point, she even contemplates getting a job, because if he's going to get married, that again is just kind of taking her role out from under her. And we start to see her get jealous. She talks to her friend, the guy who's her father's assistant, Mr. Hattori, I believe. And they go on that nice idyllic bike ride in the beginning of the film. And they have that maybe there's a little cultural idiom there that's distancing me from understanding the full idea behind. She talks about the pickled radish, how it's all strung together, and somehow that's a symbol for jealousy, that when this thing is cut, there's still pieces that are attached. Did you understand what that was referring to?
I feel like I did in the moment. I was just kind of going with it, mainly right. Because, you know, both she and her father, just the performances, they're so charming that everything they said, they could have just went, nah, 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 nah. And I would have gone with it.
I eat children. You're like, God, that's you're right. So beautiful. I love you.
I feel that. So yeah. it made sense within the context of the film. I don't think I could explain it to you now.
Yeah. But anyway, she does mention that she is a jealous person, that, and she kind of teasingly, laughingly says this. But we really start to see that kind of come out of her when the potential for her father to get married to this new lady, Mrs. Miwa, I think is her name, and they start to make eyes at each other. So, yeah, you start to see that jealousy come out, and she starts to even contemplate taking a job as a stenographer like her good friend, Aya. And so, yeah, she's contemplating like where she's going to, how is she going to fit into society now? Like, what is she going to do? If her dad gets married, then what is left for her? So that's where it starts to kind of unravel. And she starts to give in to the pressure of her aunt and her friend, all telling her, you need to get married. And she's like, no, yes, you do. You need to get married. No, I don't want to. Yes, you do. It's like, it's very direct, and just over and over again, she's beat over the head with that societal expectation.
To where it almost feels like she loses her agency, and she does. It's not like a Mizoguchi film, you know, where agency is often completely taken away. She right. still has a choice at the end, but everyone around her is telling her that she should do what she doesn't want to do, which is get married. And spoiler alert on the spoiler show, she eventually gives in.
Yes.
And sort of the miraculous thing here that Ozu does is we don't see the wedding.
Right.
She leaves to get married. Her father is there with her as she prepares, and she trains it on out of there, and then he goes back home.
Mm-hmm.
And twist.
Yeah, we get that nice little side moment at the bar after mm-hmm. the wedding, or at the restaurant with her good friend and the father, and twist.
He's not getting married. He's going to go home and take care of himself. There is no future wife for him. Noriko could have stayed with him and continued to live
yeah.
her happy life that she had. He lied to her.
Which makes it so tragic, right? That, you know, he even says she would have never gotten married if she didn't think I was getting married. And yet he's not now. It was just all a lie to kind of force her, to pressure her. Or I guess in his mind, it's just to allow her the option, because in her mind, she needs to take care of him. No one, like, if she's gone, what's he going to do with himself? Which I have to say also, he's 56 years old. This is a different time period, because he's talking about, I'm 56, I'm at the end of my life, but I guess, you know, life expectancy.
Expectancy in post-war Japan then was a lot lower than it is here in America now.
But
even
just,
though we're kind of low on the fancy country line, with, compared to the Scandinavian nations, they're living a lot longer.
It's just weird to hear that, you know, as like modern American, you're like, oh, what are you going to do, 56-year-old man, if your daughter doesn't stay home and take care of you?
You know?
But he definitely looks a lot older in the film than 56. So,
that's right.
I think it's just the time period that affects that there. But yeah.
Well, we've badly stumbled over the word recontextualization in the spoiler-free show, unless we cut that part out.
Recontextualization.
There you go. There's the Arnold Schwarzenegger. So this father figure who's been so loving throughout the film, and even when he eventually convinces her that she will be happy if she just goes along and gets married, he's seemed so empathetic to her, so mm-hmm. much wanting her to make her own decision, and then we find he manipulated her.
Well, question first off, you say he convinced her. Does he really convince her?
She
seems to go along with putting on the face that, you know, he gives her this monologue about, you need to try this, you need to move on in your life. You're going to be happy. You just have to work at it, you know, be a good wife and everything. And she's like, you know, he keeps asking her, do you understand? Do you understand? Like, he's kind of condescending in that moment.
Yeah, because I speak to my 9-year-old that way.
Right.
And she's not 9. She's three times that
she's
age.
She's 27, and he's just kind of giving her
Math Shake.
Yeah. He's just giving her this whole spiel about how, you know, explaining life to her and explaining the order of things and how she needs to get
married.
She's not
believing it.
I'm
going to jump ahead. Yeah, words are important, and I didn't choose mine as wisely as I could have a minute ago. She goes along with the decision. She's not feeling what he's telling her.
Right.
And just to follow through on that, he falls asleep, and she's still awake while he's snoring. And the film doesn't have her come out and say it, because mm-hmm. it's subtle, beautiful film that isn't going to beat you over the head with anything. But, you know, she's clearly not behind this idea, but she's now at the point where she's just going to do it.
In that earlier scene, she's going to trying to have a conversation with him about it more and open up, because she's kind of been closed off, and they take this trip to Kyoto, and she's about to talk to him more, and then, he falls asleep and kind of misses her chance. And then later when they're packing to leave, she kind of comes out and says, I want to stay with you. I want things to stay the way they are. And then he gives her that whole spiel about, no, you need to get married. You need to try this. You know, you think you're happy now, but it's time to move on. And then she, again, just kind of resigns herself to it. And he's like, do you understand? And she's like, yes. And she puts on the smile again. And yes, I understand. Thank you. Forgive me for being so selfish. And then he moves on like, oh, I'm glad you understand now. Everything's okay. But a real human being would, well, not to undercut his character, but obviously he's...
He obviously cares about her.
He obviously cares.
He thinks he's doing what's best
for her. But he is being a little insensitive there, or a little naive to think, oh, I... You know, as dads can be, I've just explained the world to my child and they say, yes, I agree or I understand.
I mean,
and not think there's still like a bubbling well of emotion underneath that she's holding back. Like,
yeah.
You're obviously just a little naive or deluded or gullible to think putting on the big smile and saying, yes, I agree, is going to make everything better.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, the people that have hurt me most in life and the people I've probably hurt most in life from all angles, I think we thought we were doing what was best for the other person.
That's usually how it is.
Yeah.
Because you're usually the closest with those people to begin with. So
that's right. But something that I loved about the film is, even in that case, we kind of talked in the spoiler-free show about how, well, more me leaning toward this than you, because you kind of had a disagreement with it. I felt like the movie is purposely very open to interpretation as to maybe what Ozu's point of view on this is. And even with this, you do see that her good friend, who she has several important encounters and conversations with in the film, is divorced, and she's okay.
Right.
She's not living this horrible, miserable life. She's all right. And Noriko has that option in the future. If she does get married and the guy is a monster, or, you know, she hates that life, that's presented as a possible future for her as well, you know, under the guise of her friend's life.
Yeah, her friend even tells her, yeah, try it out. If you don't like him, you can just divorce him. It's that easy. But were you going to say something more? I didn't want to.
What a well-adjusted movie, right? Like, it's not the end of the world either way, and it's a bummer. You know, from my point of view, watching the movie, obviously, she didn't want to do this, and I don't think that she should have had, you know, the pressure on her to do this. For my 21st century, sitting in a chair in an air-cooled building,
in America,
perspective is, yeah. You know, she shouldn't have had to have done that. Yeah. They should have just left her alone.
Woman,
you know,
power.
Yeah, and let her do what she wanted to do. But, you know, this is 1949 Japan, and maybe that wasn't Ozu's point of view, but he does a great job of not telling you what his point of view is. Yeah. I don't want to be told something by a film. I want to be shown something.
My interpretation, at least, is even though we're given that option by her friend, hey, you can get married and then just divorce him if it doesn't work out. To me, you get the sense, and she's even called old-fashioned by a relative, I think by her aunt, saying that she's a lot more old-fashioned than most girls nowadays. To me, you get the sense that it is a tragic thing. She's not the type of person to just go and get married and then, yeah, if it doesn't work out, she's going to be fine with being divorced. She, at one point, she meets an old acquaintance of her father, another professor, who got remarried, and she, again, puts on that big smile, but at the same time, she's telling him, I think what you're doing is filthy, being remarried. That's very distasteful.
And she's so charming when she tells him that. Yes. He thinks it's hilarious.
And she thinks it's, yeah, he thinks it's hilarious. He doesn't take it seriously, but obviously, through the course of the film, later, she feels bad about even saying that to him and how she meets his wife, and she's a very pleasant person. And she starts to say, I even thought that you getting married is distasteful, father, and that's where he falls asleep, and she doesn't really get to have that conversation with him. And again, how much of that is her putting on a face and trying to smooth things over with her dad? There's a lot of layers there where we're just getting a facade a lot of the time with her smiling, but there's little moments where you can kind of peer through and see the tears and see the frown and the sullen look. You know, she does, again, Setsuo Kahara does an amazing job putting on all those faces and wearing so many different layers to her character.
I think that kid's got a future. She might just have a future in pictures.
Just a little bit, yeah.
And
she was known as, what was it, the goddess of Japan at one point. You know, she was so popular and like kind of the face of post-war womanhood. Yeah.
She's brilliant in this movie.
She is brilliant.
She's really good.
But yeah, all that to say, I thought her being in that type of person, that she'd take that seriously and that she's more old-fashioned, that this is more like a tragedy for her. It's more like a funeral than a wedding. And I think you get that. We're going to go into, I guess, our Eye of the Duck segment here. Is it okay if I go first since we're talking about
that? Yeah, let's do it.
So Eye of the Duck segment, we talk about the key scene of the film. And so for me, the key scene of the film, again, in a situation like this, most films would show the wedding, right? We totally skip over the wedding. But to me, what's important and what I think is a key scene of the film is that scene right before she goes to get married, where we see her and her father and her aunt and her in her bedroom getting prepared. And she tells her father, you know, she gets down on the ground and kneels and tells him, thank you for all your care and your love through all these years. And she's really giving up. She says earlier in the film, she was so selfish for not wanting to get married. And now it is almost like a selfless act, you know, like a sacrificial act.
It is. She's sacrificed.
Sacrificing herself for his happiness and for the happiness of others around her.
Is there an... Okay. Yeah. I'm having a moment here, not to interrupt your Eye of the Duck. Is there a point where there's a cross behind her near the end, or where something makes a cross shape whenever they're on that railway landing? I'm going to have to go back and watch it now.
Maybe. I don't recall seeing
it. I hadn't thought about that.
But yeah, she's definitely...
it's not going to take a lot to make me watch this movie
again. Right. She's definitely sacrificing herself for, I guess, for the happiness of others in that situation. But... what's also symbolic to me is that, again, we don't see her at all from the rest of the film. It's like she's died at that point, and the wedding is like a funeral. And we even get that shot after they all leave the room. I think it cuts outside to the boys with the cars one more time, and then when it goes back inside to her bedroom, it focuses on a mirror, and the reflection of the mirror is the seat in front of the mirror. And, again, the room is just empty. There's nothing there. And so... to me, that is like a symbol that she has passed away now, that she's given up of herself in this preceding, the absence of the wedding is almost like a indictment in a funeral in itself.
She's literally no longer Setsuko Hara. She's whatever her new name is, her married name.
Right.
If Japan follows the same naming traditions as America, I actually don't know.
I don't know, yeah, because usually the first name is... usually the, you know, we say Setsuko Haro, but I think they would say Hara Setsuko. They would say the last name first.
That's right. So was this image of the empty room, is this your Eye of the Duck?
That's kind of, well, those two scenes, that, you know, that moment in the bedroom and then that shot later of the mirror would be like my combination Eye of the Duck. And two eyes of the duck.
That's right.
Duck's got to have two eyes.
That's right. Thanks, David Lynch. So I would be remiss. I don't think I can go right into my Eye of the Duck now. I think we'd be remiss not to talk about the final shot of this movie, since you compared it to a funeral. Mm. There's grieving. The father, it's almost like a double recontextualization, because, okay, he was manipulating her at the end the whole time. He never had any intention to get married. He just wanted her to marry off. He's great now. Everything that he wanted to happen has happened. No.
Nope.
The final shot is him breaking down and crying, which made me cry. I'm not gonna lie. Yeah. I teared up on that part. He just, and it's not just a gentle cry. He's crying pretty hard.
Yeah.
And it's open again for interpretation. Is he crying because he regrets doing that? He regrets manipulating her. He wishes she would have stayed and they could have kept that idyllic life. Is he just crying because he's gonna miss her?
Yeah.
It's up to you to decide.
Yeah, I think there's definitely some nuance there. I don't know if he necessarily feels bad about lying, you know, he's kind of laughing about it. Like, this was a necessary thing for him to do. I mean, she's going to find out now. He's not going to get married. What kind of relationship are they going to have at this point? But yeah. That reminded me, even in my Eye of the Duck, I think he even says to her, like, this is the end of our time together. This is kind of like the end of our life together. So it is like a death of their relationship. Like, oh, you're going to move on and you're going to have a new life with your husband, but, you know, this is the kind of the end of you living with me, the end of our whole dynamic.
Man, I'm getting bummed out.
And so, yeah, that then the procession after that is definitely a grieving, like something has died. I mean, their relationship, their whole life together has passed away. What do you think about the apple? I've always thought about that. He cuts the apple. He's like unraveling the peel.
He takes
with a knife.
The peel off the apple. Yeah. It well, you could take that so many ways. I'm so bummed out now, man.
I'm sorry. You were so excited about this.
I was. Now I'm bummed out. Like this conversation, like the movie, I was still like, you know, joyous at how great a film it was. But now I'm kind of bumming out on what happened. So yeah, before he breaks down and cries, he's peeling an apple. He's peeling the skin off with a knife. Really, the sound effects while he's cutting it were kind of in contrast to the rest of the film, too. You don't really get, like, an in-action scene. I noticed the sound there, and the cutting noises were kind of amplified.
Right.
So what does this symbolize when he takes the peel off the apple? Has he kind of taken he's skinned the apple. Is it like he's killed his daughter's free will and choice? Has he taken away her innocence? Has he just completely changed her? You know, the space around the peel is the most nutritious part of the apple. Once you get past there, you're not getting any nutrients.
That's deep right there, yeah.
You could take so much from it. This movie's so good, man.
I thought about, you know, she mentioned the jealousy being like a pickled radish strung together, and the peel of the apple is strung together. It's all one piece as he cuts it off.
Yes, that's, I think, too, with the sound, that you're really getting, like, he's not just chopping off a piece. Yeah. He is doing it that way.
Or could it be, like, the unraveling of his life? You know, the peel kind of comes off unraveled, and it reveals the scent, you know, what's underneath.
Yeah, and then, you know,
I mean, there's a lot of different ways you could take it.
The oxygen turns it brown, and it's nasty.
And then you've got the pillow shot at the very end. You know, again, Ozu frequently inserts these different static shots of nature, the surrounding locale around where the scene is happening. But this is, I think, the first time it just cuts completely away to a new setting that's not in that moment. And it's just the shoreline. It's the waves crashing against the shore, and the tide comes up, and then it fades to black. So what did you make of that?
That is the actual last shot.
That's the very last shot.
I was so misty-eyed from him crying. I forgot about that. Yeah.
Is there a commentary going on there? Are we just getting a nice nature shot to end it with?
I mean, there's got to be commentary there, right? Like, the tide is always going to come in. You can't fight the tide.
Hmm. Maybe something there, yeah.
Yeah, maybe, you know, she just couldn't.
The tide of the social pressure, you know, coming against her.
Yeah, man. Now I'm thinking this is more like Mizuguchi than maybe I originally thought, but maybe not. I mean, maybe it means something. Well, we don't know if he's saying, "Oh, it's horrible that she couldn't fight the tide." He may be saying, "You can't fight the tide. You should just go with this arranged marriage. Things are better this way."
I think there's more nuance there, at least in my reading, to think like it's not necessarily like good or bad, but it's a mixture. And I think that's why there's so many different opposing views.
The tide just happens.
It's right. This is the flow of human history. You can't fight against it. This will always happen. You know, like you will grow up and you will need to leave your parents, and that relationship will be different from there on out. But it's a joyous thing, but it's also a sad thing. So it's bittersweet.
The water coming in is composed of everything that has ever died in the ocean. Billions of years
of
life.
Lots of bacteria in that ocean, yeah.
That's right. Now dead in little bitty pieces, and she'll be that one day, too.
It's the circle of life.
That's right. That's right. The Lion King coming this summer from Disney.
That's right. That's her plug.
How long do we have to talk about
it
to get paid?
How much were we paid by Disney?
We got to make sure we get 25th frame to put the graphics up there for us.
Yeah, that's in the contract.
That's right. And I think that we have to get at least one Beyonce mention. Beyonce. We got that in there, too.
Is she in that movie?
We get an extra $5 if we mention her, because I think she sings one of the songs.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
That would make sense.
Childish Gambino, Danny Glover.
Oh, we'll get through that snap. Too. We got to go back to your Eye of the Duck moment.
That's right.
So what was the moment of the film for you that just kind of summed everything up?
So we didn't talk about this. It was kind of serendipitous that we didn't talk about this part in the spoiler-free show, because it's not a spoiler. It's in the middle of the film before you know how things are really going to shake out. But they go to a no-play. Which it's been great learning more about no plays watching.
Yeah,
all
we
movies.
Talked about no plays before, right?
Yeah, a little synergy here.
Yeah.
So they're at this no play, and you know, it's depressing and sad, and it's about aging and dying and time moving on. Like, it seems like all of these no plays have been about.
Right.
So.
And it's kind of wraps up. It's kind of like the film within the film in a way.
You know, yes. I love those, man. Yeah. I'll never not like that. I know it's like so easy to do, but it's
so cool.
Great.
Yeah.
It's the best.
When it's well done, especially.
Yeah.
And it's not overt here. It's just, okay, the song that in the no play happens to be about similar things that are going on in the film. Like, you know, this, I don't know, what was it about again?
I think it's more of a feeling and mm-hmm. just the general, there. So much of this film is about the feel, not necessarily maybe even what people are saying. And I kind of got that from this because it's, you know, this very hypnotic mm-hmm. scene where they're, you know, they're singing this sad, sad song about life and about how it just keeps going and, you know, we're all going to die and
lost lovers like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because eventually one of the lovers is going to die anyway. Right. I mean, nothing on earth is going to last forever. And her situation is possibly about to change, Noriko. And she's there with her father and they're enjoying it at first, but then she notices that her father's suitor is also there. And there's this moment where she's just kind of trapped there. She's hearing this sad song. Her father is next to her. She loves her father.
And he's having a great old time.
He is.
He's
got
smiling.
A big old
just
smile on his face.
Enjoying himself to death.
That's right. And she's thrown out of the moment. She just can't help but keep looking at the suitor. And it's not like a creepy, you know, I'm married to my dad, not you thing. It's just, she's going to be replaced by this person. She had a place. She found happiness, which is really hard to do in life.
Right.
Man, all you Instagram people trying to make it look like you got it together, right? I'm on you. I know you're not that happy.
We know.
That's right. With your family bumper sticker on the back of your car, I know you guys are, you know, you're not living in perfect
throwing
blitz.
Plates.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And, you know, she's thrown out of the moment, and she's just... we get these cuts to her face, and you know, we not like literal cuts where someone's slashing her with a knife, but it is like her heart
man, this guy violent
is being slashed.
Oh yeah, she's grief stricken. Yeah, at the thought of losing that relationship with her dad and this other woman stepping in. You know.
Yeah, and it really does sum up the entire movie, and I really do think it's the jewel of the film. Thanks again, David Lynch. Because it's really. She's happy at the start of the film. She and her mm-hmm. father are smiling. They're laughing. They both feel, you know, just really happy that like life can continue like this. And it doesn't. Now these other factors are introduced. In this case, in the no play, it's the suitor coming along and everything is thrown off.
And it's so subtle and there's no dialogue this whole scene either.
Nothing.
It's just all through, it's all about the emotion expressed on her face and the different like cycles that she goes through, happy being there, just kind of watching the play, resigned to that, and then seeing her dad make a slight nod at this woman and the woman nodding back and smiling. But there's so much told through all that, and then her head droops and she's just emoting like the way Setsuko Hara emotes on screen. It's just delightful and heartbreaking all at the same time.
What actors, man.
Yeah. And I love the scene, right? You know, this is kind of like, I guess, my third Eye of the Duck, or I don't know, just a scene I really enjoyed.
Go for it.
Right after
it's
that.
It's getting metaphysical.
They're walking back from the play along the street, and the dad is obviously just, you know, talking about how great the performance was and everything, and Noriko abruptly says she has something to do. And so the way this scene is shot, though, where she walks off just a little ahead of him, and he keeps walking the same direction, I guess, obviously, the awkwardness of when that ever happens to you in real life, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, I've got to go. I'll see you later. But then you keep walking the same way.
So she kind of breaks into a run.
Right. She breaks into a run, but then she kind of like is just kind of steadily ahead of him, and he's walking behind her. And again, one of the only moving shots in the film where it's tracking behind him and behind her, where we see the distance now between the two of them. Again, symbolic of what is happening in their relationship. Nothing has to be said there. It's just pure image giving you the dynamic of what is going on between the two of them. And I thought that was so great. It's really well done.
Man.
Good stuff.
It's going to be tough to top this one.
Yeah, it really is. Like I said, this has been a joy to rewatch. It's been one of the favorite Ozu films that I've seen. Really loved it when I first saw it. I think it's only gone up from there. I gave it a 4.5 originally. I'm going to have to give it a 5 this time. Yeah, so.
And on my much bigger, grander scale of out of 10, I'm going to have to give it a 10 out of 10.
Contrarian, Nick. Yeah. Yeah, 5 out of 5, 10 out of 10. Yeah. Apples and oranges, whatever you want to call it.
It's perfect, man.
It's a good one. Go check it out if you haven't already. Hopefully you have because you just listened to this whole show about the spoilers. But yeah, next time we're going to get into one more Ozu film for our Japanese Masters series. We're going to talk about Good Morning, a later film by this master from 1959. It's about two boys who go on a silent strike to pressure their parents into buying them a television set.
So, I wish my kids would go on a silent strike. Yeah,
right. Are you kidding me?
I only have one kid.
Yeah, no, I have four small ones. So sometimes we play the quiet game and it's really just for our own benefit, obviously. Yeah. Classic. But they haven't caught on to that yet. So.
Yeah, it's tough to do that with one. You know,
like, hey, let's play the quiet game.
You just don't talk.
Just
son.
Don't talk. That's what I want to say.
I can't wait till someone makes a spare 1940s style Japanese film about our relationship where I tell him that
in so many words.
That's right.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. Again, you can email us at filmshakepodcast@gmail.com. You can check Nick out at his blog, thenickexperiment.blogspot.com.
That's right.
And check out all our other shows on the 25th Frame Podcast Network. You can go to their website at 25thframemedia.com.
There's
lots of great
good shows on there.
Yeah.
I've been checking out everybody else's
good
show,
stuff.
Man.
Go listen to, if you haven't, speaking of Japanese films, if you haven't listened to the, if you haven't seen the movie Shoplifters from Koreeda, from, I think it was 2018, it came out. It was nominated for Best Foreign Film last year. Go check that film out and then listen to the Magic Lantern podcast as they review Shoplifters. And I got a lot of good insight about that film and Japanese society from their show. So good stuff.
You know what I didn't get any info about Japanese society, but I was laughing really hard?
What's
that? Good Times Great Movies that just came out about Makami. Never have to watch that movie now. Thanks, guys.
Have you never seen it?
No, just the Paul Rudd clip on Conan.
Nice.
That's it. And the dancing.
Yeah,
I watched that
even
regularly.
If you haven't seen the movie, you can go check out the podcast and still get a lot of good enjoyment
I've
out
not
of
had
it.
A bad experience yet.
Yeah, good stuff. Good shows. Yeah, go check out 25th Frame and keep listening to Film Shake. We'll catch you next time.
Take it easy.
And they're making eyes at each other at the no play, getting a little frisky
there.
The
no play, you say?
Yeah, the no play.
Oh, that would be my eye of the duck.
We're so like...
the no...
what our structure of this episode is just disintegrated. All right, maybe we should start over, do something different.